Greetings, everyone. Kevin Winder here with Beyond Everything Radio. I've got a question for you. Ready? What does it mean to be religious? Have you ever noticed how the world looks at all the religions and concludes that they're all basically the same? I mean, from the outside looking in, it's not so easy to tell them apart. Today, we're continuing our look at Paul's sermon in Athens because he's laying the foundation for what religion is and how faith is totally different. Paul proves that faith in Christ was not intended to be another competitive religion, but something totally different that puts everyone into the conversation. So, by learning about our own frameworks of religion, we're going to see Paul's framework much clearer. Won't you join me right now as we learn to see beyond everything? Okay, so last week we introduced Paul's sermon in Athens, and really he has a particular way of addressing the God question. And I think it's a really important model for us because he brings everybody into the conversation. It's not the typical discussion about religion, which is religion by exclusion. It's actually faith by inclusion. It's really 180 degrees from what we typically seen. And we're going to bake this out over the next couple of weeks. And last week we started with the question, you know, who or what is God? And kind of came to the conclusion that we really need a new question. We really need something that pushes us in a different direction, not backward, not in a regressive place, but forward and progressive and inclusive, not exclusive, as I said earlier. And today we're going to look at the question of what is religion? And I think this is really insightful, the way that Paul kind of gets at it. And today is going to be a very interesting process of kind of getting around things in a roundabout way, and I hope you'll stay tuned and kind of check it out. You are going to have to put on your thinking caps and work a little bit, but I think in the end you're going to have a framework that really is helpful and hopefully transformative. But, you know, what Paul's doing, rather than diminishing the worldviews of those in Athens, and I've heard this passage preached so many times, and most of the time, it's viewed as though Paul is kind of shooting down the fact that they have an altar to the unknown God. It's kind of like, well, you know, you have that, but let me just tell you what really is the case. I really don't think that's where this is coming from. Instead, I think Paul includes them into a bigger framework of understanding. When we get a bigger picture of Paul, when we kind of pull back a little bit, which is what we're going to do today, I think the church would really do well to adopt a similar posture to Paul. And I just don't think we're doing it. I think we can do a lot better, especially when we want to talk about how does the church speak to the rest of the world? What is the posture of the church to the rest of the world? I think Paul models something really helpful. Check out his verse in Acts 17, 22-23. It says, Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For I passed along and observed the objects of your worship. I found also an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God." Now that is where we're going to camp today. And let's just kind of pull back and look at this and realize that the Areopagus, where Paul is standing, that's the cultural and philosophical city center. I mean, think about Plato. Think about Aristotle. Think about the influence that Greek philosophy has had on the entire world. You know, it's not just a place where the cultural and intellectual elite convened around big ideas. I mean, they certainly did. But it is the absolute epicenter of the modern conversation. It's the epicenter of the modern conversation. And that's where we want to go if we're going to have this conversation. Let's get to the mind of what everybody wants to talk about, right? Let's not just have our agenda and put it out there. Let's get into the global conversation and see what faith actually speaks to that. You know, so it's kind of like Paul is headlining a national TED talk here. You know, Paul is there promoting this strange new thing, which we see in verse 21, and which was the title of last week's introduction to this passage. And so today we are going to consider the modern conversation. You know, I'm going to access this modern conversation by first making what might be a startling statement. Then after I make the startling statement, I'm going to talk a little bit about Jesus, and then we're going to talk a little bit about Paul, and then we're going to come back to this place in Areopagus, right, where he's giving this sermon. And it's a little bit of a roundabout way, like I said earlier, but I think it's an important kind of backstory in order to get a framework to answer this question, what is religion? What is this all about? Okay, so here's the statement. Christianity was not intended as an alternative religion. That's the statement. And I know you may call that a clinker. I often call those clinkers. A clinker is similar to a, and if you think about a plumber with a big pipe wrench in his back pocket, he turns around in your small bathroom and the wrench strikes the side of the porcelain sink, makes this horrible sound. And you kind of pull back and you wonder, oh my gosh, did he just break something? And the clinker is kind of a mindset when somebody says something and it kind of clinks against your inner framework. You kind of push back immediately. Well, I don't know if that's true. I don't know about that, you know, and I know that it's kind of a clinker. Okay, so let's examine it. Let's look at, like I said, we're going to do this. We're going to unpack religion a little bit, but we're going to look at a little bit from Jesus. We're going to look about church history. We're going to look a little bit about from Paul, and then we're going to get back to the Areopagus. Okay, but I get that this is a shocking statement for some of you. Some of you, you've already believed this and you know this to be true. But Christianity was not intended to be an alternative religion. And, you know, if you look at modern evangelical Christianity, it sees itself now as a distinct world religion, which is in direct competition with all other world religions. It's in competition with other belief systems and other truth claims. It's very distinct, right? And I'm not saying that Christianity does not have distinctions within it compared to other world religions. What I'm saying is that we've created it into a religion like all the rest. And it's easy to see how we got here, especially if you look at church history. I mean, the Reformation, if we want to go back to church history, we're going to talk a little bit about this. It's important to know that, you know, in the 1500s, there was a huge shift, and it took place, you know, within the Christian world around that time. It took place over hundreds of years, but, you know, primarily in this time known as the Reformation, when the Bible got into the hands of the people, not just, you know, the paid staff, the clergy, and the hired hitmen, so to speak. The Bible became open to everybody, and that meant everybody could read it and interpret it, which is very dangerous for those who had control. But the Reformation was Christianity's version of the Renaissance, right? The Renaissance was the bridge from the Dark Ages into the modern age, right? It's the rise of rational thinking. It's the rise of the scientific worldview. It's the literacy and the gain of education among a broad spectrum of people. And as such, the intelligence rose, and it created this cataclysmic shift known as the Renaissance. And it's a cultural shift. And in this space, in the Christian, in the church history space, you know, it allowed matters of faith to be understood and repackaged and categorized and labeled and dissected, and we put them in our binary framework of the new rational mind. And so this change really turned esoteric belief into formulas and structures. I mean, before it was experience, really. Your faith was about experience. And the tradition of the Christian mystics, which was all the way back there, kind of forked at this place. And the Christian mystical tradition went off in one direction based on inner experience. And the Reformation went off in another direction based on textual criticism and literary criticism and rational thinking and processes. So it's an important split for you to be aware of, because what happened is this created huge distinctions. This was the environment that gave birth to systematic theology. Christianity, as a result, lost some of its experiential fluidity, as I like to call it. It sort of moved from experience and became a rigid analysis. It kind of landed in our figure outers. And when that happened, these distinctions created what I call otherness disease, We began to see ourselves distinct from everybody else. And if you go down and you look at the, you know, your phone book at the, you know, Christian churches that are in your town. I live in a town of about 60,000, and there are over 120 different Christian denominations just in my town. And why is that? Well, it's because we've got into this habit with the rational mind of creating distinctions where we're different than the people down the street. The church down the street is different than us. You know, they baptize babies, and we certainly don't. They allow people to drink alcohol, and you know, even their communion is real wine. Ours is just grape juice. They play rock music, and we would never play music at all because music would be seen as sinful, right? These all these strange and nuanced differences all came from this place. And it's not about what they're believing. That's my point. It's about how they're believing it. It's binary. It's a different epistemology. Okay, so that's our detour into Christian and church history, right? As we talk about religion, it's important to see how it started to form in the minds of the people. But let's look at what Jesus gives us. You know, and there's so much more that I'll be bringing to this, but we're going to just kind of chop it down to this today. Just know that Jesus did not come to establish some systematic theology. That wasn't his purpose in life. Hey, I'm going to go down into the world and create systematic theology for people. You know, his proclamation was really for this counterintuitive kingdom, right? Everything's upside down. I mean, the way up is to go down, right? To gain greatness, you do so by serving others. You give your life away in order to receive. In order to preserve your life, you have to die, right? The rule of this kingdom that Jesus over and over talks about is love. And according to Hebrews 8:13, Jesus made obsolete the rules that governed how people were to relate to God. Now, this is important because this is talking about religion. And Jesus is basically undermining the rules of religion. He didn't abolish them, right? This is not about abolishing the law, right? He says he came to fulfill the law, not abolish it. But this is really about a new framework for how we relate to God. You see, every other world religion is like a ladder. It's a stairway to heaven. And these are a system, a process, a government. And if you jump in and do our process, you will rise up and eventually you'll meet God or be with God or find peace or have whatever. And that's not what Jesus is doing. He's actually modeling the fact that you don't go up to God. God has now come down to you. 180 degree difference. So Jesus undermined institutions and systems that can't bring us to God. And there's so many neat parables of healings and such where he's like, hey, man, if you want to be healed, just break the Sabbath today and pick up your mat and walk, right? Just minefields over and over again that the religious people stumbled upon and couldn't get their heads around because he was undermining that. He was a complete renegade in many ways. And he just tried to free people from the institutions that were around them. And it wasn't just the religious institution. It was the, you know, governmental and institutions, government institutions as well. You know, they were putting burdens on people just like religious institutions. And for instance, like when he says in Matthew 23:23, he says, you tithe mint and dill and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law. Justice and mercy and faithfulness. You know, what is Jesus saying? He's saying, look, you're all wrapped up in your religion. I mean, you're tithing out of your spice rack, but you still don't have justice or mercy or faithfulness. And so he's like, you're missing it. And so what Jesus is doing, he's getting to the thing beyond the thing. He's helping people see beyond everything, right? Jesus' ministry really closed the gap where religion and state systems failed to liberate the constituents. And so he could not possibly be instituting another religion when his whole message and proclamation was the liberation from such institutions. That's a powerful argument here about why Jesus didn't establish a systematic theology. He didn't come to start an alternative religion. It's something different, right? It's faith. It's not a religion. Now, let's go back to Paul. in the disciples, as well as Paul. Now, if you remember, Paul was called Saul prior to his conversion. And if you actually look at the scripture and their lives, what you discover is that they're not so much converted to another religion as they are completed from wherever they started, which is varied. I mean, the whole Bible is varied with experiences. It's not like there's just one experience, one valid process. Everybody had a different experience. Why? Because if you go back to the first recording, everybody had a different God question. It's the same God question, a different framework for how they addressed it, right? The fishermen, which were the working class, had one way of relating to God. Tax collectors, which were the ruling class, you know, like Matthew, they had a different question, a different framework. Centurions certainly had a different question, and they were the enforcing class of society. The Samaritans were the immigrant class, and they certainly had a different experience. Prostitutes, invalids, and the sick were all part of the poor class of society, and each of them also had a unique theological grid. And you see, Saul's elite Phariseeism, he was a very devout religious guy, if you remember. He was part of that religious class. You know, and that religious faith that he had was not eradicated by his conversion. It's not like he undid everything he ever believed. No, it completed what he believed. And as a result of the completion, it transformed it into something new and alive and fresh and not dead in litigation. What's the word I'm looking at? I don't want to say liturgical. I can't come up with a word. Anyway, it wasn't so fixed in of a framework. It was an experience. That's my point, right? The Jews in his day remained Jews. The Gentiles remained Gentiles. The Samaritan woman and others remained Samaritans. The centurion didn't abandon his army and go follow Jesus. He went back to being a centurion, and everybody returned each to their own. Now, the difference is that when they returned, they're still the same people, the same question, the same framework, but now they have the addition of Christ, which completed their framework by expanding their faith and the God question, right? So here's another example, just through the disciples and through Paul, of how Christianity can't be another alternative religion. And, you know, early Christianity just, it couldn't be. It couldn't be an alternative religion. It was an alternative means to God, right? Religion was the way, the hard, fast rules of obedience and law and everything else, that if you did it all right, God would shine on you. And that was it. Religion is a framework for ascending to God, but the Christ story is the opposite. It's the story of God descending to us, coming to us. And it's not till much later in Christian history that, I mean, we effectually rebuilt our temples, right? We call our sanctuaries sanctuaries, not auditoriums so much, because we see them as sacred space, as though sitting behind the curtain in the front is, you know, the mercy seat. We have reestablished our ruling class. We have paid clergy and pastors and teachers who, you know, are full-time. And they are there to be the go-between between us and God so often. They see themselves as that, and they position themselves as that. Not that it's all wrong, only this, that we need to be mindful of the fact that we've kind of rebuilt the temple in this way. And, you know, as a result, I think Christianity has kind of diminished over time into a competitive religion, because the people from the outside can't really see the difference like we can. And let's face it, if somebody from the outside is looking in, they are easily going to make the claim that there is a lot of power and a lot of money in these systems of behavior modification. I mean, wouldn't you agree? So, with all that being said, we can prove that Christianity could not be an alternative religion. It was a life of faith, which is different, and it completes the religion or framework or belief system from which you came. Okay, and that's an important distinction here, and I think that is where Paul is coming from too. So if we go back to him at the Areopagus, he's saying, look guys, I get your religion. I came from one. You see that now? Do you see that bubbling to the surface? You see, the unknown God is that something more that they all intuited but had no framework into which to put such an experience. The altar is the religious framework. It's there in case they had to appease God. And Paul is giving a name to that deep thing that they all seemed to intuit. You see, they didn't want to miss out. Like, well, you know, this guy comes for the blue God and this one comes for the yellow God. And there might be a God out there that we just don't know, that might be bigger and heavier and stronger and quieter and distant. And we don't want to make that one mad. So let's put up an altar. Let's give it a religion. Let's apply it that way. And so they're responding to this unknown God in a religious framework. And that's what Paul is speaking about. He's saying, look, I get where you're coming from, man. I get your religion. I came from one too. He says, but let me just say something about this unknown God. And that's where we're going to go next week. Okay, so hold on to that thought. Now, as a pastor for 25 years, I can tell you that I think, and this is my perspective, I believe modern evangelicalism has kind of fallen on its face. I mean, it essentially is sitting there playing, you know, Red Rover with the culture and hoping somebody will come right over, like I said last week. And this really became obvious to me when I took my ministry online and when I kind of moved away from the brick and mortar model of serving people. The work of the gospel is not so much to make converts as we understand it in our binary Reformation-faced theology. You see, there really aren't others out there. Now, that is a shocker, too. Maybe that's a clinker for you. You know, maybe your faith system, your religion, your belief has really convinced you that there are innies and outies. And when it comes to truth, this is where we're going to get deeper into as we go into this, everybody has some truth, nobody has all the truth. And that means that on your very best day, everybody can only be a partial believer in the truth, which really eradicates this idea of otherness, which came from our theologies and our structures and our Reformation and all of our, you know, systems and rational beliefs and everything else. It's not bad. It's just how it is. But the framework is not there to convert so much as it is to complete. That's the work of the gospel, is to complete us. And, you know, a true completion may be more like a conversion in the end. But I prefer this distinction just so we can understand it, right? It's to complete any and all faith systems, because none of them are really able to get us to God. I mean, they're all containers. You know, Christ is not a container. Christ is the contents of everything. And this is where Paul is going when he says life and breath and everything. The cosmic work of Christ and Jesus is the only thing that liberates a captive, you know, and this is a captive that's found both in church and state. And we do have to be mindful that church and state, or religion and state, are the two institutions that put Jesus on the cross. And so when we talk about being captivated by them, we need to be very careful, because the work of the gospel is that liberation from such things. And so now we can actually see the real meaning of Jesus' exclusivity claim in John 14:6. And this is probably what's going on in the back of your head when you kind of push back against the things I'm saying. You're probably saying, well, Jesus said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life, and nobody comes to the Father except for me. That sounds very binary to me. That doesn't sound very open-ended. But the problem is that the church, modern religion, is often interpreting that as saying that only Christians go to heaven. But this can't be the case, because if you look, there's Abraham and Moses and Elijah in heaven, according to Hebrews chapter 11. And none of those people would even know who Jesus was. How could they be Christians? But, you know, if what it's really saying is not only Christians go to heaven. What it's saying is that if anyone anywhere experiences God, has an experience with their maker, their creator, their father, then it was the Christ that made it possible. It was the work of Christ. It was the experience of Christ that made that deep moment possible. And so in this way, God is not unknown, but known by everyone. And that is Paul's point when he says in verse 24, this I proclaim to you. Right? He's not saying this unknown God is really an unknown. He's saying, I know something of this unknown God, and he just gives a name to it. So Paul is saying, yes, I see your framework. I see your religion. I came from one too. But there's something beyond it that actually ties us all together. We are not other than each other. See, Paul is not them, and they are not Paul, but Paul is not other than them either. I am not you, and you are not me, but we are not other than each other either. It's a powerful powerful idea. And so what Paul is saying is profoundly inclusive. What Paul is saying is wide open. It's an amazing proclamation. And he shows us that the way to speak to our world, which, by the way, is rejecting Christianity as an alternative religion. You see, we've gone out there and said, hey, ours is just like yours. This is our framework. This is our very narrow and specific framework for how a person could possibly understand God. And some of you worship on Friday, some on Saturday, some on Sunday. And so the world outside can't really tell the difference. But what Paul is doing is he's showing that the unknown God is where every one of us who has ever lived begins our journey. We all begin with a question, who or what is God? We all begin with an unknown God. And Paul models here that the church is not about arguing the differences so much as it is going deeper with that tiny awakened part within us that knows that there's something more. So it's about going deeper. It's about going beyond. And following that voice is the new framework where the unknown God becomes experientially known. And to know something experientially means to know it in a different way. And once it's experientially known, everything changes from the inside out. Everything changes from the inside out. It's amazing. And so that is the window into Paul's mind. And no wonder the Bible says that thousands heard that message and believed. Now, may that be the case also for us today. Greetings, everyone. I'm Kevin Winder from Beyond Everything Radio, and I really want to encourage you to go to my website right now and sign up for Winder's Windshield. That's my weekly newsletter, and you can find it at kevinwinder.com. When you sign up, you'll join all the others in the virtual space. Each Sunday morning, you'll get a link to my blog, my radio program, and my podcast. You'll be the first to access new content, uncoaching opportunities, and webinars, and so much more. Sign up now and you'll get a free e-version of my book, Getting Better When You Can't. Now, go to kevinwinder.com and remember I spell Kevin like the number 7. Go to kevinwinder.com and look for Winder's Windshield and sign up today.